From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in an EE circle, an emotional emancipation circle. Maybe you've heard of the practice of circling up as part of restorative practices or restorative justice. Have you heard of EE circles? It's just one approach to providing what experts would describe as culturally competent care and a better approach. And right now, in this community, well, a lot of people are hurting. You don't need me to tell you about the reporting in the last 24 hours about a three-year-old shot in this city and the response from everyone from the mayor to hurting neighbors and community members. What do you do next? Data shows that Black adults in the United States are more likely than white Americans to report persistent symptoms of emotional distress and trauma, but only one in three Black adults struggling with mental health challenges receives any treatment. The reasons behind that are complex. As our guests are going to talk about this hour, one reason is the lack of access to culturally competent care. We're going to talk with mental health practitioners who discuss what anti-racist, culturally competent mental health care looks like and where we go next here. Melanie Funches is CEO and principal of Ubuntu Village Works, LLC. Melanie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Remind listeners what Ubuntu is.
Ubuntu means, literally translate to I am because we are. It is the concept of interconnectedness, saying that, like, I cannot be well if you are sick. I cannot be free if you are bound. And it means that we are all connected to one another.
Great to have you back here. Mike Boucher is with us, co-director of counseling and community work at St. Joseph's Neighborhood Center. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
Also with us on the line is W. Henry Gregory, Jr. Dr. Gregory is founder and clinical director of Rafiki Consortium, LLC. Dr. Gregory, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what Rafiki Consortium is.
Rafiki Consortium is a mental health agency, basically composed of myself, my wife, and my children and colleagues. And we do direct services, we do training, we do consultations with folks locally, nationally, and internationally.
Well, it's nice to have you with us. Thank you for making time. And also with us is Maisha Davis, Program and Administrative Director of Rafiki Consortium. Maisha, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much.
Melanie, let me start with you and just ask you, when you see the news of a three-year-old shot, where does your mind go to, obviously, the pain and the hurt and the trauma that's going to come from that?
Well, the first place I went, because I'm a mother, I went to the heart of that mom, you know, because the three-year-old had nothing to do with whatever happened to be happening in that area. The mom, more than likely, the parents more likely had nothing to do. From what I understand, they were at a gas station, right? They were just around. The baby was in a car seat doing something very normal. And my heart goes out to that family and to that community, you know, to have to process this kind of trauma. My thing is where I think after that is, how do we help that family, that community to process this, you know, in a way that's healthy, in a way that matches who they are culturally, and so that they can get to, and this is way beyond now, right? This is time beyond now to get to a place where they can, you know, cope with this and be able to move forward.
The ripples of this kind of trauma are, if we stop and think, should be readily apparent. But I think too often we think about, we put things under the headline of crime or statistics, and this is going to probably ripple for a long time with a family, with a neighborhood, with communities, with a number of different individuals. And if the system isn't designed to step in, what are the consequences long term of those ripples, Melanie?
People don't get the care that they need. And what ends up happening is what people need to understand about Rochester, and particularly about communities of color within Rochester. You know, Evan, you've heard about 6 degrees of separation. Within communities of color in Rochester, it's like 1.5 to 2. Because the communities are smaller and they are so interwoven. So that baby people see that baby may see their mom and their dad, but their mom and their dad, you know, have their family, and they went to high school with so-and-so. They went to high school. The dad played football with so-and-so. And so these ripples go on and on and on, and people are highly connected. And so when you have that people who are that connected and there's no place for them to go to process this information, to get the help they need to process this trauma in ways that speak to who they are culturally. This is, you know, people may say, you know, well, they're Spanish-speaking people, but it's bigger than that. When people don't have that, that stuff just compounds and compounds, and it can become deadly. I mean, because these things start in the mental and spiritual, but they manifest in the physical.
So let me ask all of our guests now to kind of give us their own sort of broad view of what it means to be culturally competent in care. It's become sort of a phrase that we hear a lot, but functionally it's really, really important. You know, Melanie mentioned, you know, take a family that may be Spanish-speaking, primarily Spanish-speaking. That is an obvious barrier to service if there aren't a lot of practitioners, providers who can literally speak a language. But that's just one example. What are some of the other examples that stand out to you that we can start with as we understand cultural competence here?
You want to start with me?
Yeah.
Okay. For me, it's being able to understand the nuance of what it is, who I am as an individual, or as a member of a particular cultural group. The example that I use often is the word girl, G-I-R-L, right? It's a very simple word, but if I say to Maisha, who is another Black woman, girl, I can say 27 different things by my tone and inflection of that one term. And I can be more than sure that she will understand all the undertones of what I'm saying through that one word with that particular tone and inflection. And when you're in the therapeutic relationship, is one of the most intimate relationships a person can have. And if I have to spend half of my time explaining why this is important to me, explaining who I am, explaining these things, I don't get my help, and I don't feel connected to the person giving me help.
Understanding nuance, just to follow that point before I turn to our other guests, you know, we recently welcomed the author of the book Invisible Child on this program. And for listeners who might have seen the New York Times series of stories about a girl named Dasani in New York City living with 7 siblings, her parents, primarily in a shelter. She ends up going to a private school in Hershey, Pennsylvania at the age of 15. If you only knew certain facts about Dasani, you might make some really tough assumptions. She didn't want to eat with the family that she was living with at first. She didn't. She was occasionally very, very quick to anger. She eventually decided she didn't know if she could fit in the school. And you might say, well, how ungrateful? Why is she ungrateful? As opposed to understanding, she literally was concerned about eating with people because she had to guard food for a long time. Food was hard to come by. She would give up her own food for her younger siblings in the shelters. And then all of a sudden, when it's abundant, it's hard to get your head around if you don't have that context. Similarly, when everybody around you has been, you know, you've been worried that someone is out to take what you have, it takes time to settle in. And then you have to ask yourself, as Dasani talks about in the book that we read, I think thanks to Melanie for turning us on to this, was this idea that, well, if I, quote unquote, make it, what about my other 7 siblings? What about my parents? What about my family? I don't know if I feel like I'm selling out or leaving them behind. So to the outside world, you go, well, why? You're not very grateful. How come you're not following through on this? Instead of understanding all of the trauma, pain, suffering that might lead a 15-year-old girl to act that way. That book was absolutely powerful to me in understanding, to truly understand the nuance of someone's life and situation. But it takes professionals and it takes actual open-mindedness. And I don't know if you think the system's anywhere close to being able to do that in a wide scale, Melanie.
I am cautiously optimistic.
Okay.
Because what I know, and thank God for people like Mike who renew my hope daily, that there are people who really want to do. When people enter into this field, they don't want to mess people up. They want to do good work. This type of work is very introspective work, which is what I'm so excited to have the Gregories on to talk about. I believe that people want to do good work. They just don't know how. And that's why we have, you know, the work that's happening in our community to help people learn how to do this work.
So let's ask our other guest. Mike Boucher is with us in studio, co-director of counseling and community work at St. Joseph's Neighborhood Center. What does cultural competence mean to you?
So when I think of, I want to get beyond the buzzwords, too, because, you know, some people might go to a day-long conference, and especially white clinicians might go to a day-long conference and come out and say, my God, I'm trained now, I'm culturally competent. And, you know, I think of it more as...
I walk out, got it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Check that box.
Yeah. And so really thinking of it as almost like a lifelong apprenticeship, of how do we both learn and unlearn simultaneously. And so part for me of cultural competence and responsiveness, again, is knowing history and context. So for anyone who's practicing in Rochester, do we actually understand, and I'm not saying we understand everything about Rochester, but do we understand how the institutions that are here today even got here? Who founded them? Who were they founded for? You know, as we were talking before, who was allowed into them? Who wasn't allowed into them? You know, so histories of redlining, thinking about poverty as another form of violence, not just the homicides on our streets, and also thinking about the histories of the very profession we are in. You know, a lot of us say, well, I'm a good person, I want to do good work. But that's not always the origins of how we started doing what we were doing. There's a very close tie between mental health and incarceration, particularly for Black communities, and also distrust of medical professionals. Which, again, you can look at long histories of documentation. So to be a clinician, and, you know, I also think of formal training and informal training, that I can go and get a master's in mental health counseling. I can go and get a doctorate. I can go and get a, you know, a clinical social work degree and have very little understanding of the community that I'm serving and very little legitimacy even in that community. My degree doesn't give me the informal credibility and ability even to navigate that community and understand who they are, what they need, what the histories are. And I've just found in particular, when I think of cultural competence, almost every person of color I know has great cultural competence in the white community because they've had to navigate it daily. Most white people can structure their lives in such a way where they need to know or engage almost nothing about Black communities, Latinx communities. And so that for me is white people have so much more of the learning to do when it comes to cultural competence.
Let me turn to Dr. Gregory for some thoughts. Go ahead.
So cultural competence is meeting people where they are. And always the assessor of cultural competence is not the provider, but the person receiving the service. Now, in mental health, we talk all the time about meeting people where they are. But that's not always an easy thing because we all have our perspectives. We all have intrinsic biases that we have. And if we're not careful, the systems and the providers will require that that the consumer meet them where they are, meet the system where it is, rather than meeting the consumer where they are. And that's what happens all the time. You have to jump through so many hoops. It becomes so inconvenient. You're not understood. You're assessed in a certain way. Your labels are put on you that really support the gross national product that comes out of this industry, as opposed to really genuinely being people-oriented in a way that the services can be applied and customize according to that person's individual culture. And when that's with the understanding that all of us at some level are multicultural. All of us, you know, we size our race and ethnicity, our gender, and where area we're from, and our education, on and on and on. All of that helps to make up our culture. So the only way a clinician or anyone else can learn somebody else's culture is to really be open enough to really listen to them and to learn from them. But if we're on a treadmill of, you know, let's get them in, let's get them out, and put a label on them and so we can get paid by an insurance company or whatever, we're not going to really attend to that person in their specific needs. So it requires being able to come out of this worldview, that this Western worldview that has dominated so many of our systems, and open up to other ways of looking at people and our clients, so that we can see not only what's wrong with them, but see what's right with them. Because understanding that everybody has some capabilities, some strengths, and the more we relate to them, the more we can understand folks and help them to fit in ways that are comfortable for them.
Let me just follow up there, Dr. Gregory, on one point here, and this may be a little clumsy, but you know, when you talk about a system that has this treadmill, that get them in, get them out, get the bills, send the bills out, get everything paid. I think everyone listening, no matter their background, can relate to the medical system feeling like a pinch for time to see anybody, a very small amount of face time with just about any provider of any kind. So there's all kinds of pressure going in, and yeah, you may have a public that thinks, well, no one's going to have time for me anyway, even if I did put my hand up and say, this is what I need. At the same time, for providers, for professionals, you know, you still have to pay your own bills, so you've got to get paid in some sense. And what you're describing is maybe looking at the system very differently. How within the current structures of the system can you do it differently that says you can still, as a professional, get paid enough to do what you need to do, but not be a system, not be a participant in a system that's dominated just by dollars and cents and stats, and treat people like people and aims for cultural competence? How do you start to make change from within a system?
Well, my mantra is, first, rend unto Caesar what Caesar's. So you got to write it up the way Caesar says in order to get paid, so you can keep living indoors and not elevate your mental health problems. So we understand that. But understand that working with that client may be different, where you have to be more relationship-oriented, where you have to go into their world. You have to be skillful. You have to be present like that. And so that is about assessing your own priorities. That's about being in touch with your own biases. That's about learning the skills that facilitate communication, facilitate understanding and support, so that you can be as effective as you can within that time period that you have and still give the system what they need. Of course, that's a balancing act, and it requires a lot of continual self-care, growth, and work on the clinician's part, because you can't take anybody any further than you are. So you have to continue to work on yourself in order to be able to help the clients move also.
Before I jump to my issue, just briefly, is there, and I'm thinking about Ubuntu and what that means, and everybody gives, everybody gets. How do you, Melanie, how do you see the model? And maybe what's the Ubuntu perspective on making sure that no matter what someone's background, they can get sort of the culturally competent care that they need?
Well, in the therapeutic relationship, there need, you know, we've been taught in Western beliefs that this, that the therapist is the yogi, right? They're going to come and they're going to help fix me, and I'm just going to talk to them. And when what we really need is reciprocity in that relationship, right? That we both bring something and we both get something. As the clinician, you are growing in who you are. You're doing your own work, and you're bringing your full, authentic self to that space. As the person receiving the service, you know, you're doing your work. You're bringing your full, authentic self into the space, and both of you, when it's good, you both learn. You both grow. Right? The clinician learns from the client, and the client learns from the clinician, and both of them come out better. But we've got to get away from this whole thing that the clinician, like, we create this whole thing about these super, I'm not saying they don't have boundaries or anything like that, but where I'm over here and I know this because I have, you know, my R, right? No, we're in this space so that we can grow and we can move beyond. And that when we get reciprocity, which is a lot of what Ubuntu is about, we can get to healing.
Let me turn to Maisha for some thoughts about what cultural competence means to you, Maisha. Go ahead.
Sure. So just kind of in the vein of the conversation that you guys are having, I kind of look at it in all the ways that you've been discussing, right? Very personal with the client, systemically, what does that look like? And then certainly for the clinician. So I see cultural competence, being culturally competent, as the vehicle through which healing can be facilitated, right? Healing is a very personal experience. When we think about all of the challenges that we're having in our communities, as you guys were talking earlier, what I keep thinking about is that people just want to be heard and people want to be seen, right? And so what we know is that when that doesn't happen for folk, they are at greater risk for all kinds of poor outcomes, because every behavior is focused in on either maladaptive behaviors or affirming behaviors, right? Every behavior is focused in on trying to attain that need, mm-hmm. right? The need to be seen, the need to be heard, the need to be understood, the need to be felt, the need to feel whole, to feel, have autonomy, to experience pleasure, to be loved, right? To not be in fear, to feel safe, all of those things. And so if healing is this personal experience, it's my belief and my understanding that healing can occur for all of us to be able to aspire to those needs when it's done in the context of connection. And so a culturally competent provider is focused on connection, is focused on joining with that client in a way that they do feel validated, they do feel seen, they do feel heard. And partnering then with that client, with that individual, with that family, to remove and address those barriers and those blockages that prevent that natural healing to flow and to occur in their and manifest in their lives. And so to just affirm everything folks have been saying, cultural competence is about being humble, right? It's about placing the expertise right at the foot of the client. It is not our credentials that facilitate healing, right? It's not what we know, what steps we use, what schools we went to. Families don't care about that. Communities don't care about that. What they care about is how you feel and how you tend to me in my moment of need and my moment of crisis, and how you affirm my existence and who I am and what I'm trying to do for myself. So any one of us, right? Like any one of us, regardless of our background, white, Black, Indigenous folk, that kind of doesn't really matter when we tap into the humanity of who we all are, right? Put the credentials to the side and just show up as your authentic self, right? And allow that which is within you to connect with that which is within me. And that's where we get that synergy going to facilitate that healing. And when we think about systems, right, like these systems are working the way they're designed to work. As kind of Mike talked about, you know, our history has demonstrated that these things are operating the way they were designed to work, these systems. And so they aren't intended by virtue of policy and procedure and practice to really be about supporting, growing, healing, evolving the community. They really are about kind of keeping folks right where they are. And so the crazy thing about systems is that we are the system too, right? We are a part of these systems. And so how do we change that? We begin to dismantle the system in us first. We dismantle the oppression within us first. As providers, we dismantle the white supremacy within us first, the internalized racism within us first. When we do that, then that kind of does that ripple thing Mel's talking about, right? And that becomes, then we get that swell of energy that slowly but surely does move the needle and turn the curve on how the system on breaking the system down from what it is to what we need it to be.
I'm really glad you bring up what confers credibility in different communities, and you built on what Mike is saying there, Maisha. So let me ask all of our guests now. I want to just talk about certification, training, and what maybe our guest view is most important versus just sort of carrying this ostensible credibility just because you've got some glistening institution, some ivory tower institution certification or degree. What's the real training and certification that you want to see? And Maisha, can I start with you? What does have a positive effect?
So, yeah, for me, I think it's really about self-awareness, right? So any type of program, process, intervention that any one of us as practitioners in this work take on that allows us and requires us to be self-reflective, to understand where is that thing that's within me that inhibits me from really making the connection to facilitate the work in a real way, in a meaningful way. What is it? What are my biases, right? What are those prejudices that I don't think about, that I don't want to talk about, that's not, I don't validate, I don't embrace them in real life, right? But they still exist in me because I'm a part of this culture that raised me, right? So where is that stuff? I think any kind of work we do, whether it's restorative practice, whether it's, psychodynamic, whether it's humanistic, cognitive behavior, all of those things are great, right? But at the root of kind of really being able to put forth some meaningful work and meaningful change in our systems, you got to start with self. So work that allows you to be reflective, to really look at yourself and really make some decisions about how you position yourself in a way to be a servant, to be humble, to relinquish, if you will, that expertise that you have and give it to the people that you serve. That's really where I think the work needs to happen. It's great that you have a PhD or a medical license and you've been through school for your whole adult life. That's awesome, right? But the people who are suffering and dying don't really care.
Dr. Gregory, what do you think? We got him on mute, Miles. I don't know if that's us or Dr. Gregory. No, huh?
No, here I am.
Oh, there you are.
Okay.
No problem, sir.
So people don't care how much you know. They care how much. People don't care how much they know until they know how much you care. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the models that we all learn in school are very cognitively oriented because that's consistent with this Western culture thinking that the logic of the mind has dominance over everything else. Mm-hmm. But as we look at more in indigenous models and Afrocentric and Ayurvedic models and such, what we see is a stronger focus on emotions. And if you're going to work with people of color, you have to, at some level, go into your emotions and help them to process their emotions. When you talk about all this violence in the street and this unfortunate situation with this 3-year-old getting killed and all, you're talking about people who are not dealing with emotions. In our culture, in this Western society, avoidance is a main coping skill. So we avoid emotions because they're uncomfortable. They take us in places we don't want to be and we can't necessarily control them. But the more we push them down, the more they will just jump out at unexpected times. And then we'll find ourselves doing something extreme or something that we're sorry for because we have not processed, become comfortable with, made friends with those emotions, and we're just acting out. And we're seeing so much of that in this society right now because, to go back to Maisha's piece, people are not feeling cared for. They are not feeling connected across the board. So when we're talking about culturally competent training, when we're talking about anti-racism training, we're not talking about just benefiting the problems of black folks. We're talking about all folks because all of us suffer you know, as Mike said earlier, when any of us suffer, all of us suffer, you know. And our society as a system is not very people-friendly. So what we're working with clinicians to do is to skillfully, consistently, and with some depth, go into the emotional pieces and help people to identify their emotions. And when we can identify emotions, then we can learn from them and then release them. Then release them. Because emotions are messengers. So some of the systems we teach are very emotionally focused to increase the emotional competence so we can reduce some of the acting out that happens on the client's end, excuse my language, and on the provider's end.
Well, let me turn to Melanie Funches, CEO and principal of Ubuntu Village Works, LLC. When it comes to calling more people into the conversation and, frankly, into the work, as you might say, they may ask that question, you know. Well, what kind of training? What kind of certification? What programs are out there? What do you like? What would you say?
Well, what I would say is, why don't you come join us? Here in Rochester, we have partnered with Rafiki Consortium to offer two different trainings, Indigenous Psychotherapy and Anti-Racist Culturally Competent Treatment. And these two certifications are like semester-long programs that help do that work, to help people do that introspective work to be able to show up better for their clients. And we started offering them over a year ago. I think now over 70 people, 70 different clinicians around our community have experienced these trainings. And we want people to engage, you know, because we want what my goal is, and I'm going to be very clear, is to change the community's standard of practice, the way we do business within mental health in Monroe County. You know, so because what I know is that while this is, again, this is framed up as culturally responsive care and people think this is for people of color, what I know is when clinicians do this level of work, this level of introspection, they are better for everybody. And all the boats will rise.
Mike Boucher, you know, it's interesting. I think about the therapy that I've gone to. I've been to therapists. And I probably notice the degree on the wall, right? You know, you sit down and you probably notice. And it does strike me as sort of a logical distinction that as a white client, whether I notice this or not, you know, upper middle class background, I'm looking for the degree of the certification. To me, that carries this idea that, okay, I'm sitting down with someone who's going to be able to do the work that I need, as opposed to, you know, communities of color that have been left out, ignored, you know, might not be looking for a degree on a wall, but to be understood, you know, to have credibility within a community, which mm-hmm. doesn't just come from far away. So maybe it is this kind of training. Maybe it's reputation that takes time to build or rebuild. But do you think that we as a community, can we become a community that has the reputation that says, no matter your background, you're going to get the kind of care that you need? I mean, as Melanie said, she's optimistic that we'll get there, but we're a long way from there. I mean,
cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously. Maybe realistically cautiously optimistic. Where are you on that?
Well, you know, again, almost any time I hear the word community, I start thinking, what do you mean by that? And so, because there are a lot of communities within community, and also just thinking about, you know, culture is not monolithic either. There are a lot of expressions of culture. So when I think about some of this, I'm thinking about the ideas of how do we provide care and accountability. And at the Neighborhood Center, one of the things we've done is we combined our counseling and social work departments many years ago, and we called them counseling and community work. And so do you have a foot in sort of the working with, whether it's an individual, a family, a couple, but always trying to think about, so where do they live? Do they have access to food? What's the level of violence that they need to be thinking about? And how do all these social pressures impact how they are, their wellness, however you define wellness. But then within any sort of community-based intervention, we need to think about how individuals move through those spaces too. And so there's this constant balancing. And I also don't want to come across as saying education has no place. I mean, formal education teaches people a lot of very important skills. But it's also a really different starting point, because I know in other traditions, like Dr. Gregory was saying, in more indigenous traditions, as far as I'm aware, like the community actually brings forward the healers and said, these are our representatives, these are our healers. And so I think, you know, if you're a clinician in Rochester, I'll speak for myself, then you can't just stay in your office. You've actually got to be in the community you serve. I don't think you have to necessarily live there per se, but there's familiarity that's required for one to even know nuance and meaning, similar to what Melanie's saying. And you don't just get that by being there over a weekend. For me, I really do use the sort of apprenticeship model, and that's one of the reasons why people like Melanie and Dr. Gregory and Maisha have been just amazing teachers for me to be with, and both they accept what I offer, but then they also give a lot too, and so this idea of receptivity. And, you know, I also just have to say that my experience of most white people, but particularly white clinicians, actually don't even know they have a racialized self. And so then when we hear Dr. Gregory say self-knowledge is crucial, like just that's a really important starting point to know that this is how I move through the world. This is how I move through systems. This is how they engage me, and that not everybody's going to be moving through the world in those same ways or being received or cared for by the system in the same way.
I want to take a phone call, and then I want to come back and have our guests kind of weigh in a little bit more about maybe Melanie and guests can talk about anti-racist, culturally competent treatment, training and certification, and a little bit more about what that entails. But let me grab this phone call from, I think, this is Sam in Rochester. Hi, Sam. Go ahead.
Hey, so this is a really timely show for me. I just had a conversation. I'm a social worker. I'm working in the city. I'm working with almost entirely, young people who are people of color. And I was having a conversation yesterday about this idea of identifying and regulating emotions and how adults, you know, model that for kids and things like that. And I had a person who was a person of color, another adult that I work with, talk about how that's white people stuff. And I wonder how the panelists maybe would address that with somebody who sort of believes that there's some sort of cultural conflict between this idea of, you know, being able to identify and regulate your emotions and adults having a role for young people in particular around teaching them, modeling how to regulate your emotions. That the conflict seems to be, you know, cultural a lot of the time in my experience, where people look at me as a white provider and say, well, that's white people stuff. That's not how we do it. And I want to be like, no, everybody needs to learn these skills, but I don't know how to always address that.
Yeah, I appreciate the awareness of the question here. Let me start with Melanie Funches. What do you think, Mel?
I want to kick to Mike. Because white speaks to white.
Okay, Mike Boucher.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it actually starts with an acknowledgement that what they're saying is actually accurate at some level, that a lot of this stuff has been white people stuff. So I'm not saying people of color or BIPOC folks don't need emotional regulation. But I guess it also comes down to who gets to tell them what emotions to regulate and how. And we've had, you know, that's been a dominant theme in our systems, is saying to people, here are the emotions that you get to display. And here's the way we want you to display it. Outside of that, why don't you keep it to yourself? And that's why having teams of clinicians is really important too, and having colleagues we can go to say, how do I think this through? Is this something we could tackle together? I don't think like can only help like. Like you've got to be the same person. But I think it's a great starting point just to acknowledge that there's truth in what the person is saying, and saying, well, maybe I have something I can offer you, but maybe not. Maybe we need to find out who can offer this to you in the best way.
Okay, Mel?
You know, I agree with Mike, because what someone says, you know, that's white people stuff. For me, what I heard, not in my professional self, but in me, Melanie, the chick stuff, is who are you to tell me what emotions I get to have, when I get to have them, where I get to have them, or that I'm not regulated, right? If you spit in my eye and I am outraged, I have justification to be outraged. But what our society says is that in dominant culture society, we have to mute all of our things. And so what I hear in that as a Black woman is, you just want me docile. You don't really care about why I'm upset or what has happened to me. As long as I'm docile and I'm not a threat, we're okay. And that's what I heard, like, in that everybody needs emotional regulation, but who gets to choose when and what? Baba? Dr. Gregory?
Yeah, if I can add to it. So when that person says, you know, that's white folks stuff, a response to that person might be, you're frustrated. You're having a hard time accepting that. Helping that person process, that person is expressing an emotion. So we can talk about emotions or we can deal with emotions. We can help that person identify what emotion they're having because that's what is being expressed by this challenge, by this verbal aggression. So that when I'm talking about going at emotions, I'm talking about the feelings that are behind the expressions. So when we do that, people don't have to act out as much. The walls tend to come down, and guess what? We tend to start working better together. Because ultimately, to me, the goal is we have to get better at working together on this planet. And the more diverse our participants, our repertoire is, that means the wider our possible solution base will become.
Maisha?
Yeah, sure. So I'm teaching, such a great question. I'm teaching structural oppression this semester. And one of the things we're looking at is the social construction of oppression, the social construction of identity, the social construction of just about everything, right? Race is a social construct. Our systems are a social construct. Folks got in a room and made a decision about what white is, right? And what Black is, and what short is, and what tall is, right? We've made some decisions about who's in and who's out. And so because of that, we kind of have this norm that we lean to in our work that says, this is the way to be, right? Because this is what's normal. This is what's acceptable. This is what's invited, appropriate for everybody. This is the standard. And so my question then would be to anyone who is receiving that type of feedback, I think what that says is that the feedback is more so not about what emotional regulation is or the need to have it, right? But who gets to define it and who gets to determine what that is for me, right? We live in a culture where the system has determined what wellness is, has defined wellness. And wellness is not necessarily about what actual health and wellness looks like for everybody. It's based off of one very linear standard. So while emotional regulation is a great concept and it makes good sense, does it align with what those young people want and need for themselves? Does it align with what the people of color, those young people of color, your colleague of color, what they need for themselves, what she wants for herself, right? And so I one approach to kind of manage through that is have your consumer, have the population tell you what wellness is, tell you what health is for them, tell you, define what success means for them, define what good feelings are, emotional regulation might look and feel like. And start there as you're to develop the intervention with them versus for them.
Okay. Sam, does that help?
Yeah. I mean, I think, though, to just sort of pick up what Maisha was saying, like, I think that my struggle has been that, you know, that's exactly what I personally as a social worker always strive to be able to do, is to, you know, help young people to identify what they're feeling and what their needs are and how can I support what they want and need, not what I think they want and need. And I think that my struggle has often been that I have adult colleagues of color who say, no, we give kids directives. we tell them what they're going to do. We don't ask them to do things, or we don't, you know, it's not about what they want. It's about what we want. And that's the part that I struggle with, is that, you know, that's personally, I don't think that allowing a person to, you know, identify their own feelings and identify their own needs and their own goals, I don't think that that should be, I understand why it is, but I don't think that that should be something that is quote unquote white people stuff, right? I think that everyone deserves that opportunity. And I think that a lot of the reason that folks of color have not had that opportunity is exactly what all of the panelists just said. I mean, that's an example of structural racism that I think that people easily overlook. So, I mean, I appreciate all of that feedback, and I, you know, I'm going to continue to, you know, try to support my students the best I can. But that's just, you know, it's a frustration that I've had with some of my colleagues who sort of look at me like, well, that's not how we do things in my culture. And, you know, thinking about some of the things that, you know, Melanie and others have said about this idea of Ubuntu and, the idea of sort of the collective and caring for each other. You know, I believe that we should care for each other. And I know that that has roots in, you know, African cultures. And it's not white people stuff. So I always get really frustrated when I hear that.
All right. But Sam, I got to say this, okay? What you need to take this class, but first, because no, really, because there's deeper things. Like what, when they're saying, you know, we give directives, there's a history around why these things happen. You know, there's a history behind it. And sometimes people do these things unconsciously because generationally there's things that have been passed on. Because some of these, a lot of the directive behaviors that you see with Black people specifically, because I can speak for myself, is to protect from white harm. Okay? So these things, the threat may have changed, but our perception of the threat may not have changed, right? So, I mean, this is much deeper than I can talk about on this program, but what I would recommend when we talk about getting into the class, please, because this will give you answers to some of these things.
How can she sign up, and how can the public sign up for these?
Okay, we're getting ready to launch these the information for the spring semester. If you want to get information, please contact me at Melanie, M-E-L-A-N-I-E, at Ubuntu Village Works, U-B-U-N-T-U-V-I-L-L-A-G-E. Village Works, WORKS.com. And soon as the spring schedule comes out, I will send it to you with all information about how to sign up. And it's free.
Sam, much love to you. Good luck to you. Thank you for making that call. Let me just read a couple of other emails here. Rick says, Evan, I really appreciate your guest statements that we have to remember that cultural competence includes but goes beyond traditional credentialing. I wholeheartedly agree that developing cultural competence is an ongoing task and requires that we are continually learning about ourselves and each other. Thanks for having them participate in the show today. Michelle says, chiming in on how people develop genuine cultural competence and credibility. I can't underscore enough the importance of embodiment. Theoretical training can set up a framework for experience, but cannot replace experience. This will be difficult for white people who have chosen to live in spaces that were deliberately developed to segregate and partition daily lives and experiences away from people that they may be called upon to now serve. My own experience as a healthcare provider moving to Rochester, of having to get our realtor to show us houses in the city rather than just Pittsford or Brighton, underscored how insidiously cultural incompetence gets perpetuated through racist practices, yielding physical segregation, depriving us of embodied connection. And P.S., hello to Melanie, and thank you for your investment in my ongoing work to become culturally competent through PLTI. That's from Michelle.
Hey, Michelle.
So a lot there. Mike, you want to jump in?
Well, I just want to say, too, and acknowledge, and some of this has come out of my experiences in being in the multiracial context, that the overlays of white supremacy and the roots of this have hidden things from all of us. It's not just, you know, white people who've been damaged by stuff. But the cultural undertakings that I think we're talking about here benefit everybody who's going through them, these deeper reflections on who we are, where we come from, and accessing deeper traditions that are generally not available to us or have been hidden from us. And a lot of it starts with just naming the truths. That, you know, I'm thinking we're coming up on Indigenous Peoples Weekend. Like, there's a whole history that we're trying to address now with respect to what does it mean to be on unceded territory, and what are the historical impacts on us if we are a settler? What are the historical impacts if we're in an indigenous community? What does this do to us in terms of our how we move through the world, how we view ourselves? What are the stories that have been told about us and who got to tell them? So, like, it's a lot of unpacking. And some of it's really uncomfortable. Some of it's incredibly liberating. There's tears, there's laughter. But doing it as a community is also really important. You don't go read a book by yourself and suddenly come out the other side. So just acknowledging that a lot of this work is, it's a communal process and everybody's learning collectively. It's not just, you know, so white folks can get up mm-hmm. to speed.
Because all of us, the easy way I said is we all drank the same Kool-Aid. You know, over 400 years ago, a lie got told. And structures and systems were built on the lie of white supremacy, white superiority, and white and black inferiority. And a lie got told. And we've been living, and all of us have been living in the context of that lie ever since.
If you want to learn more about these different trainings, anti-racist, culturally competent treatment for black families certification, also, the training for Indigenous Psychotherapy Certification. You can contact Melanie. Melanie@UbuntuVillageWorks.com. They're working with providers on setting up spring courses and training there. It is free.
It is free.
And they would love to hear from you, no matter where
you are. There's no financial charge, but there is a cost.
Oh, yes. And yes, there is a cost. You have to bring your full and authentic self and be ready to do the work and dig deep. But there is not a financial cost to this, to the clinicians.
I want to thank our guests for a stimulating hour of discussion. Melanie Funches, CEO and principal of Ubuntu Village Works, LLC. Thank you, as always. Nice.
Thank you for
the
opportunity.
Mike Boucher, co-director of counseling and community work at St. Joseph's Neighborhood Center. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks. Great to be here.
On the line with us, Dr. W. Henry Gregory, Jr. Dr. Gregory is founder and clinical director of Rafiki Consortium, LLC. Dr. Gregory, thank you for your time and expertise.
Thanks for having me.
And Maisha Davis, a licensed clinical social worker and program administrative director of Rafiki Consortium. Thank you, Maisha.
Thank you so much, you guys.
More connections coming up in just a moment.